You're listening to FilmWax Radio, hosted by Adam Shartoff.
Everybody, welcome to episode number 390 of FilmWax Radio. I'm your host, Adam Shartoff. Thanks for tuning in. Today's show is two segments, one with filmmaker Kenneth Ang, whose documentary, My Life in China, has been enjoying a broadcast or rebroadcast on America Reframed, which is on the World Channel. Kenneth's film is about his father, who raised Kenneth and his brother in Boston, who had to make a lot of sacrifices by leaving his home country, even though at the time it seemed like the right choice to make. I wonder if in this day how much things have changed both in China and in the United States, just how much more it seems like a bad choice, how much better China is looking these days. But hey, that's a whole other episode. The other segment today is with FilmWax Radio friend Larry Fessenden, whose son Jack, who's a high school teenager, has recently made his first feature film. If you can believe it, he made it in the last few years. So he's actually started making it when he was, I think, like 15 years old. Jack's 17 now, and the film is called Stray Bullets, and it's sort of a crime thriller. There are other elements in it that are amusing and scary and moving, but it's essentially a crime thriller. Larry is in it, as well as James LaGrosse and a few other actors. And I got to see it at the Woodstock Film Festival back in the fall, and right away we started talking about bringing on Jack, along with his dad, onto the podcast. And so we're going to get to that in just a few minutes. The film is coming out in a bunch of cities around the country, including in Los Angeles at the Lemley and in New York City here at the Village East Cinema next Friday, February 10th, although they're having a big premiere night and party on the 9th of February at the Village East Cinema. And we'll have all the specific details and links for you on the just show notes. But we'll be very happy to bring Larry and Jack on in the second segment. So that's the episode. Let's cut right now to my conversation with Kenneth, who was in Los Angeles when we Skyped the other day. And I will keep people up to date about the next opportunity to see his beautiful portrait of his family. Again, it's called My Life in China, my conversation with filmmaker Kenneth Ang.
因為爸爸是那個人偷渡了,幾多人呢,兩三人可以來到香港。我們來關時呢,密碼在山頭等著啊,你一走,你地線呢,他們出個的行了,那該不會不走啊,不走,我們要推車,開車啊。誰就來那條啊?他說,你放在山頭上住啊?
It's 7 o'clock, and you look far more rested and put together. This doesn't seem fair.
I am pretty lame. I went to bed early because I had to work today. So
I figured
we just got dinner and then I just came home.
Oh, okay. Well, how are you doing?
Good.
Kenneth Ang. Since we're going to be on the topic of your documentary, which is really your dad's story, it's called My Life in China. Where is he living?
Right now, yeah, they're still in Boston.
Oh, he's in Boston?
Yeah. That's where I'm from.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Kind of grew up there.
I recognize the subway system, but I wasn't sure, because there's a scene where he's riding the subway you know, where he's kind of thinking about aloud about how maybe he should have stayed in China all those years. And I think that's going to have a lot of impact, that line, you know, for everybody right about now. I think I should have stayed in China too, actually, right about now. They have better human rights, it seems. I shouldn't actually make a joke because, of course, you know, that's not necessarily so. But I still found that a very, very interesting aspect of how, you know, life would have been easier all around. And I assume economically as well as maybe just socially and otherwise for many people, including your father.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I mean, the film's about regret and chasing an idealized idea or version or idealized idea of what life could be. And, you know, what I see in a lot of the immigrant communities is a lot of difficulty and a lot of unrealized dreams. I guess the American dream is this idealized version that they are striving for, but it didn't work out for my father. He came over and had to, you know, change his profession and adapt to a new life here. And, you know, so what he set out for his life sort of kind of changed, and he started living for his kids and started, you know, everything he started doing was really so that I'd have a chance at getting my education.
You would have an opportunity. Yeah, he felt like he could at least hand down that opportunity. Or opportunity in general to you and your brother, if not, since he seemed to have lost that himself. So he was a very well-educated man. I mean, that, you know, it comes across clearly in the film, and came here and ended up having to essentially be a cook in a Chinese restaurant or in various Chinese restaurants over the years, which, you know, what was a beautiful part, because I always think of those people who work in takeout restaurants, they become sort of faceless to most of us, you know, or,
yes,
you know, they
exactly
lose identity, I mean, just as a, you know, as a result. But what was so beautiful is your film gives your father, obviously, everything back and more. I mean, he comes out as a real hero, you know, so, you know, kudos for that. But tell me a little bit about, because I'm real curious, how you worked it out with him and how he agreed to become the subject of a documentary and just open up his life to, I mean, clearly he understood the consequences.
I don't know if he thought about the consequences, but I think he was attracted by a plane ticket to go back to China, a place he hasn't been to for 18 years. And, you know, the idea of spending time with me as an adult. I grew up, you know, with a, you know, kind of close family, kind of them taking care of us and caring for us. And, but I, you know, as that was happening, I kind of grew up very embarrassed to be who I was, and just ashamed of my own heritage and culture, because just trying to assimilate and avoid being bullied in school, kind of ran away from all that. All the Chinese-ness, all, you know, the, just being in Chinatown with all the other families that kind of were raised that way in Boston. So I feel like this was a way for me to reconnect, and I think the offer to spend time together was very attractive to him, not just the plane ticket, but, you know, and I'd like to believe that, you know, and it's really through the process of just making this film that I was able to really rediscover who I was, my roots, and really understand what it means to be both American and Chinese. And I think that's what a lot of, you know, first immigrant, first generation kids go through and are feeling, you know, trying to be part of this American experience, but also honoring the tradition and also keeping the heritage going and also doing what's right, for, you know, for the family. So I was kind of torn that way. But, you know, just growing up, he would always, you know, allow me to just lead the way kind of and just sort of mold how I want to do things.
Right.
So, I mean, I think there was a lot of trust involved, and he basically, you know, took my lead and let me, you know, believe that I would do something okay, you know, but I don't think he ever actually took me seriously as a filmmaker, yep. You know, like, just, okay, son, you know, I'll go along with it. You know, if you make a film out of it, that's cool. But, you know, I don't think he really believed that it was going to be any big or not, or just a film that would reach people. You know, I think it was, you know, he was just humoring me as something, you know, just to spend time with me and just let me you know, get better at my craft. This is when I started this. It was about 2006 when I had just finished my previous film, a Japanese high school baseball that actually premiered on POV, which, you know, I really have no idea how I accomplished that. And I think I, you know, when that happened, I really didn't appreciate what happened. And I sort of let that opportunity slip through my hands. And then, you know, so it's sort of a big accomplishment for me to take a film like this that wasn't, you know, commercially like successful or going to all the big film festivals, you know. So to be able to take this little thing has been really meaningful for me, and to be able to do it with a film about my father that wasn't, you know, well-funded, you know. So it's, I don't know, it's a miracle to have gotten this far.
How did you raise the money for you and your dad to go to China? You also had to have somebody, there must have been a third person, right?
Yeah, well, I mean,
was there a sound person?
During the success of Kokoyaku, my high school baseball POV film, I applied for the Guggenheim Fellowship. I met someone, like a composer, during going around screening that film, and he told me about the Guggenheim Fellowship, and I applied on a whim. I was trying to figure out, wait, I made a film now, it's on TV, I need to continue. So I wrote a proposal and somehow got the Guggenheim Fellowship, and I basically, like a drunk sailor, I poured it all in, you know, being coming from a poor family in the first place, and, you know, being poor my whole life, you know, getting the Guggenheim Fellowship was just a miracle in itself. Also to be able to, you know, the chance to make another film. And so basically pouring all in and then coming back with all the footage. My Life in China was originally a collection of four stories of immigration. My father's story was just one of them.
Oh.
So,
did you shoot other stuff that's not used?
The other three stories were scraps, but I have footage. I have like five short films about the other three stories. I mean, yeah, 5 minutes documentary about these other three stories of immigration. But I had shot shot the whole thing, my father's story. So came back broke, and I realized maybe I should just make the film about my father's story and just shelf the other three stories.
Well, it ended up being not a bad decision at all. Sometimes the decision's kind of made for you. You just have to recognize it and then, you know, sort of grab it. But was part of the Guggenheim, like you agree to take a year off, or how does that work? Do you get, because you obviously needed a great amount of time and to stop looking for other sources of income and then pay for, how long were your trip? For round-trip tickets, I assume that was alone, at least $5,000. I don't know.
Yeah, I got awarded the fellowship in 2006, and then we went to China for about 5 weeks. Almost 3 weeks. But we spent like 40% in shooting my father's story.
I was basically wondering if the Guggenheim, if they give you money and they, within the understanding that you're going to, you know, follow certain parameters, like, you know, taking a year off to do nothing but work on this project, things of that nature.
Yeah, I mean, basically the Guggenheim allowed me to, you know, not go back to freelance and launch this film. And in the proposal, I had originally written it to be the launching of a film. So I went in knowing that, or I wrote the proposal knowing that there was a good chance I wouldn't be able to finish it. So, you know, having spent all the money and returning back from China, I was basically forced to go back to freelance and basically just try to figure out how to pay rent and make money to stay afloat. So there were really no parameters. I could have bought a house with the Guggenheim Fellowship, but I wanted to follow through with my proposal and at least launch the film. The proposal was just to launch the film. It wasn't to finish it. So it's something that's a really good thing about the Guggenheim Fellowship, because they'll let the artists really
It's a starter.
Even if they're not going to finish.
I'm sorry, I interrupted you. It's a starter budget or what have you, right? So you can get things.
Yeah, it's basically a seed grant. But yeah, I mean, I should have, the wiser idea would have probably to buy a house, you know, try to, you know, start paying for a mortgage and then building equity and then
savings. Wouldn't have been a problem.
But, yeah.
That wouldn't have you wouldn't have run into any problems doing that.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe I would probably, you know, filed bankruptcy or something like that at some point. But yeah, I mean, the economy's been tough. I mean, as an independent artist, not having savings from these past 8 years, I've basically crawled my way here, just, you know, making ends meet. I had to move my life from New York to Los Angeles. You know, I went to Czech Republic, Prague, to do a whole other project in between. And just have just figuring out my whole journey here with this film and trying to release it, you know, since we didn't get any big offers to distribute the film, we've had to figure it out ourselves. So that's been kind of interesting, too.
Well, we can mention at this point it will be on American Reframed, which is nice, which is an extension of POV, correct?
Yes.
They're sort of it's a subsidiary channel of theirs, I think. When is that happening? When is the premiere?
We premiered last May 24th during Asian Pacific American Heritage Month, but we are having our rebroadcast January 31st.
Oh, January
31st. And okay. Yeah, but we're doing something new. We're going to do a Facebook Live stream during the broadcast, and they're having me be part of this conversation and just getting people involved. And I guess they're trying new things, so it's really exciting to use this new medium to try to reach even more people, because it's going to be streamed to the whole world. So my friends in Czech Republic and Japan and China, everywhere, you know, they can finally follow along and actually see the film, and that's pretty exciting to me.
So they're rebroadcasting on the 31st, but is it going to be broadcasting for a while?
I think it'll be rerun one more time, but I think the stream is going to be up on the internet for about like 2 days. So it's not going to be that much more available. I think our contract, we had to take it off of streaming in North America. Because I think we're getting ready to do an Asia release. We're going to stream it in Asia and New Zealand and Australia and these other places.
Oh, wow.
So that would be interesting.
So Dad goes through quite a bit of reckoning, it seems, and reconciling during the film. So there's, I don't know if there's quite closure for him. I don't know. Did he find peace on some level in some manner, or a certain maybe lightening of his burden by going and being involved in the documentary?
Yeah, I mean, I think he finally came to terms with his decision. I mean, it must be tough to live with regret your whole life and wondering if you made the right decision. But I think seeing life there and seeing how it was... he couldn't really go back to that, and the fact it sort of helped him also appreciate what he has in America and appreciate what, you know, he's given for myself. And I think seeing me come to terms with what he's given me also has helped him appreciate what he's done. I mean, I don't think anyone that sacrifices himself or themselves that way or just people that put forward so much for their kids, they don't really think about, they're not really, you know, like reasoning, I'm doing this for my kids. They're just being selfless and in the moment.
Right.
And just,
right. It's usually not so thought out, and it's usually just instinctual, and, you know, maybe people who are doing it aren't even self-aware of how big a sacrifice they're making.
Yeah, and I mean, I think he's living a happier life, and my younger brother has kids, so... It's sort of taken the heat off me, and he stopped kind of pressuring me and lecturing me, and he's just basically accepted me, and that's what I noticed, you know, having coming out of the film, experience of making this, and I don't know, I mean, I really recommend just spending time with our parents as adults, because they're just the forgotten group of people, you know, we have our own lives, but it's just really good to just talk more to our elders and our, you know, people that have come before us. And
yeah,
I totally, because it's done a lot for me for my soul, and, you know, letting me like understand myself better and
so you're a better person. Trying
to, just recalibrate what's important and what I value in this world, and try to spread that. It's really contagious, and, you know, I think we really need positive energy and positive. Just movements these days.
Yeah. So you're recommending everybody get themselves a Guggenheim and make a film about their parents.
That would be helpful.
You're recommending, right? It's good advice, Kenneth. I know your mom, it's a bit of a complicated, she suffers from mental illness, and she's doing okay?
Yeah, she's stabilized. I mean, when after she went through menopause, she developed, I guess, pre-form of dementia, paranoid schizophrenia.
Okay.
This is during high school, and I was the kind of kid that had a lot of friends but was embarrassed about where I came from, because I kind of grew up in the projects in Boston and just embarrassed about my family and who I was. So I was the kind of person that lied about where I lived. And so I would get dropped off, you know, in Boston a few blocks away and then just walk home. And but, you know, I mean, one thing I regret is not bringing more awareness to mental health more. You know, I tried to put my mom in the film as much as I could, but we just simply couldn't afford to bring her. But at least she would be in the beginning, and there'd be some parts, some mentions in the film. And so
she didn't feel like lost over.
And it's just kind of heartbreaking for, you know, for me to go through that. But I just want to at least bring some attention to other people that have gone through this or are going through it, because we need to have more understanding for people that are going through it.
I agree. Of course, your dad ended up seeing the film, which I'm going to remind people is called My Life in China. Did your mom get to see it too? And what were their reactions? And
my mom saw it at the Boston Asian American Film Festival this past 2 Novembers ago. Wow, we did film festivals starting from 2014.
I remember.
Yeah, and we had our world premiere at the San Diego Asian Film Festival in 2014. And I flew my father in for that, and he'd never been to California, really. And he came in with my aunt, who's in the film, and to have him in the theater during the premiere, and just sitting amongst the audience and just seeing what his son had chosen for his life, I mean, and having it come in fruition, it was one of the most unforgettable moments of my life, just to, you know, finally have him understand what I've done, because there's always been a disconnect trying to, like, tell him what I wanted to be an artist and be a filmmaker. And, you know, I feel like he never really understood that and really never took it seriously. Like, oh, yeah, how's work, you know? Like, never really seeing any concrete work that I've done.
Yeah, this was palpable. Very much so. So after that, I guess he had a newfound understanding, if not respect, for his son. Had to be an incredible – I can see you got a little emotional even talking about it.
Yeah, I mean, so yeah, this the making of this film has been really, like, very important for me, even though we haven't gotten to the peaks of filmmaking, but just the act of doing it and the fact that I can continue to do it has been, you know, what I've gotten out of this experience of just getting this film out. And, I mean, the blessing is to continue, and I just hope to become better and, you know, be part of this community of filmmakers that are trying to affect positive social change.
Well, you're doing it.
Do what's right.
You're doing it. Congratulations. And glad you kept on me and got me the link. And, you know, I'm just glad finally to had the conversation with you. And because it's really a powerful documentary and very moving. And I thought there were just, you know, your dad was, you know, one of those quiet heroes. And, you know, it's just a fantastic story. So, you know, well done.
Thank you. I mean, I think it's time for people to tell their own stories and do it in their own authentic way. We need to fill in the space and just, you know, as any diverse voices so we can give each other more exposure, you know, about our American experience. It's just we all live different lives. We're on different journeys. But I think that's what really unites us all is, you know, and I think a better understanding of each other would do us really good moving forward.
Thank you, Kenneth.
Thank you, Adam.
Great when you have a circle of people that are so creative and so talented, and I've been able to bring them into sort of a community around Filmwax Radio. And one of those people is one of my favorite people, Larry Fessenden, who, along with his son, has created this film. Now, this is primarily Jack. Jack, his son, not only directed, acted, wrote the story, but also had a large hand in editing it, and maybe even. And most impressively, wrote the score. He's a musician as well. This kid is just a really obnoxiously talented, multi-hyphenate. But the film is very amusing, and it will be having its premiere theatrical premiere next Friday, February 10th. So do check it out and meet Jack, meet Larry, meet the cast, and have a good rollicking time while you do it. Here's my conversation with Jack and Larry Fessenden.
What happened? Who's shooting?
We were supposed to be in and out of there. We weren't supposed to pull our guns.
I'd appreciate it if you stopped bleeding out in my back seat.
Hey! So, where are you off to?
Going to clean out my dad's trailer.
I've been doing some thinking, Ash.
Why is it I'm always doing your chores for you?
You practically live at my house.
Don't move.
You gotta deal with us.
We'll know they're here.
My understanding is we got a bit of a situation.
All right, so we are in the not even new yet. I mean, it's sort of, it's not even your new digs yet. You can't even call it that. We're sort of...
We're just new digs elect.
What?
New digs elect.
Precise.
Haven't been sworn in yet.
And so you're right. Glass Eye Picks has moved out of their Dumbo location where you guys were at for like 10 years, you said, something like that, or in the ballpark
ballpark, yeah.
And now you're in the East Village and only a couple blocks from home. So that's
gonna
little
get
perk.
A lot more done.
You're going to get a lot more trips to the Bean, I think. Is
Okay, yes. I have a preferred coffee shop on Avenue A, which I will frequent.
Oh, really? Yeah. So that will you'll divulge that information off mic.
Yes, that's correct.
You don't want to, because you know what happens. Everybody starts going there in droves, and then the quality always. You can't get a coffee there anymore. As Yogi Berra said, nobody goes there anymore. It's too crowded.
That's awesome.
That's the dulcet tones of Larry Fessenden. It's exciting. You're like a regular on this podcast. You've been on this podcast more times than I have, almost. And you're joined today by this. Who is this young man sitting to your right here?
This is my son, Jack Fessenden. He will introduce himself.
Very good.
Hello.
Hi, Jack.
I'm Jack. Yeah, I directed Stray Bullets.
And
right
to the punch.
Right to the punch.
You're excited. It's
and yeah.
Well, we're going to come back to that in just a second. Okay. I do want to give a little background. Another body just fell through the or prop, as Larry Fessenden calls it in his business. I was actually at your world premiere. It's kind of nice to be able to. I think it was your world premiere. It was at Woodstock. US. Was that?
That was the our U.S. premiere.
Oh, excuse me.
We were at Oldenburg in Germany.
Oh,
a month before that. Yeah.
That then I stand corrected. So the U.S. is able to editing now. Yes, at Woodstock, and I had the my kid with me. So it was interesting because he really wasn't in the mood to go. He likes making films himself. He's 12, and he does little stop motion films. But I said, you know, I think you should watch it because you voiced interest in becoming a filmmaker too. And, you know, here's a young guy who made this film in the middle of his teens, only a few years older, or at this point significantly. But when you started this, Jack, right?
Mm-hmm.
So now that you're obviously been talking about the film for a while, because when was Oldenburg? When was that?
That was in September.
Okay. So it's a good 4 months since...
Yeah, and the movie's been done since April of last year. We first showed it, had a screening at IFC in April.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Was that for like a...
That was a cast and crew and friends screening.
I see. Oh, okay. And they did it at the Made in New York Media Center, like in Dumbo?
No, they did it at the IFC Center.
Oh, the IFC Center. I'm thinking IFP when you're saying IFC.
Oh, right.
Sorry
right.
about that. Excuse me. That's a whole... other ball of wax.
Yeah, we've left Dumbo. That's so Dumbo. That's so Brooklyn.
It's very Dumbo.
This was in Manhattan. Yeah.
All right. Well, you're teased, but it is you've been in Manhattan a long time, so that's where you're really your roots are, wouldn't you say? Like, even though you work at it, you've been working out of Dumbo.
That's right. I've been in Manhattan since the '80s, and I've been downtown since the '80s, and we had an office. in various locations in the East Village until the price went up. And then we went to Dumbo, which was fantastic. But now it's so posh.
Yeah.
We come crawling back to Manhattan.
Yeah. Those prices that escalated in the 90s now are lower. So all of a sudden it's relatively low.
Compared to Dumbo. We've downsized as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, on a more optimistic note, the film is coming out. Let's get that out of the way too. And then we'll kind of step back a little bit in time, ask you questions about just your experiences making a film at that age. The film is going to be at the Village East, right? Which is on 2nd Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It's just around the corner from here. And it's going to be premiering Friday,
February 10th.
February 10th. Yeah. Okay. Street Bullets, February 10th, Village East Theater. Big premiere.
And we're having a gala evening on the 9th, actually.
Okay.
So open to the public. We'd love to see people.
Is that
there.
Right?
We're hoping to have some of our cast mm-hmm. and crew and supporters.
Okay.
And the public is welcome. And Jack will speak after the 9 o'clock show. So we're sneaking in the great tradition. We're having a Thursday night premiere for our February 10th opening, which is in 10 cities across the country. Very exciting.
Well, where else?
The Lemley Theater in L.A. I'm very mm-hmm. excited about. I didn't get right. to play there myself until I was 35,
uh-huh.
and my kid is premiering there at age 17. We're also in Cleveland, Houston, Texas, uh-huh. Boston. Where else, Jack?
San Francisco.
Chicago, maybe? Or?
No, not Chicago yet.
Fuck
right?
Chicago.
Maybe not.
We're hoping for Chicago. We're not going to fuck them yet.
No.
And Seattle? No, mm-hmm. is that true?
Denver.
Fuck yeah.
It's a nice, yeah. It's a nice city, but.
Denver. Didn't we get Atlanta?
I don't know. Well, I think we did. That's fantastic.
That's huge. Yeah.
And then, of course, this will be day and date with iTunes and Amazon. And on iTunes, we have a great making of, so we're very excited about that. You know, mm-hmm. they have this new thing where you can get an extras package, and you can see an earlier film of Jack's called Riding Shotgun, which he made when he was 13,
mm-hmm.
and a fabulous...
Was that a feature or is that a short?
No, it's a short. Mm-hmm. This is my first feature.
So okay. Mm-hmm. And you shot this all upstate, right? Wasn't it all shot up in the Hudson Valley?
Yeah, well, we have a house up there, and we go up every summer and spend a lot of time there. So whenever I write a story, I generally tend to see it, you know, in that kind of environment with, mm-hmm. You know, characters that are sort of like the ones that I have in my life, my friends from upstate. And so, yeah, we shot it in Woodstock, New York, and in Stone Ridge. The trailer location was just a 20-minute drive from our house, which is where the whole crew stayed for the entire shoot.
And so you actually wrote the screenplay, correct?
Yeah.
You directed? And yeah. did you edit with Dad?
Yeah. I mean, I mostly edited myself, and then my dad would help me.
Okay. Yeah. Pardon me. And you act in it? Was that not a bit overwhelming for you at any time?
Well, you know, I just sort of think of it as it's all one and the same, you know. Mm-hmm. Writing and directing and editing to me is sort of mm-hmm. filmmaking.
Mm-hmm.
I would never think to hand my story off to someone else, at, you know, after shooting it or something like that. At least not now. Not when I'm just starting out. And then in terms of acting, I generally see stories sort of through my own eyes, how I would experience them,
mm-hmm.
at least at this stage in my, you know, in my process. That's how I come up with my stories. And so I always am sort of just placed into the protagonist, whether it's, you know, good or not. That's just sort of how I see a story. My next project, that I'm sort of veering off from that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
It's a bromance.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay. But and schoolwork didn't suffer?
Schoolwork suffered a little bit. I mean,
okay,
I would always.
Schoolwork suffered a little bit.
So I edited Stray Bullets basically the first half of 10th grade.
Uh-huh.
And then going into the winter, I was working on the score, and we were in the studio on the weekends. And, you know, we would go and do color correction, color timing for 12 hours, you know, on Saturday, and then 12 hours on Sunday again. And, you know, then came the sound mix and the ADR. So these were such frequent engagements that, you know, they take hours upon end. So if we did that on a weeknight, which we sometimes did, there was no room for homework. And, you know, I was excited about what I was doing. And
no plans for college anyway, so what's,
yeah, exactly,
what's the harm, really?
Well, now we're finding out about that. But
so, it's a double-edged sword. I mean, I guess when it comes time to show your little home project, it's like, here, come to the movie theater. You can invite the you can invite the admissions people to come to the Village East Theater.
We're learning it's all about the numbers. It's not about all that extracurricular stuff.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, it's a brave new world.
Hmm. As in money towards the endowment?
Yeah, well, it's those numbers, too. Yeah.
You know.
No, I don't.
Or just these... numbers. Are you talking about grades?
I'm talking about grades and these standardized tests and,
the tests.
And all that.
Got it.
And
yeah.
So,
right.
You know, you...
I thought that, well, some schools still, I don't mean to get too far afield here, but some schools, don't they really take into account?
We'll see.
As well? Okay.
Yeah. I mean, there's sure. There's art schools and then there's regular schools.
Sure. Sure. So even aside from that, was that not an overwhelming thing to go through, or is that...
No, it totally was. And, you know, we finished the movie very promptly, within 8 or 9 months of ending the shoot.
Post-production.
And really, and only post-production.
Mm-hmm.
And I was only able to edit sometimes for a couple hours a week.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the reason we were able to finish so quickly is that the movie was entirely planned out beforehand. No scenes were cut. It was exactly how we'd storyboarded it, and mm-hmm. and in
okay,
the order
so where
of
does
the
that
script.
Come from? Did that come from also from Larry?
He's always that? Taught me. We do that together. We plan out every single shot beforehand. We have a shot list mm-hmm. that we stick to on the day, usually, and that helps us see the film in our mind, so that when I'm editing it, there's no surprises. You know,
you're editing in a sense as you're going
exactly
already, yeah. Right? Do you normally work that way, Larry, on your own films? When you direct?
I really do. Mm-hmm. I love the idea that you conceive of the meaning of a scene and therefore the way it should be, the way the information should be revealed. You know, a close-up is a very specific way to start a scene. You don't know where you are yet. You only know the content of that first shot, and on you go. And it's fun to look at a script that's been written and talk to the writer and say, so what? How do we start this scene? Is it a wide shot, a close-up? Is it... What information do we reveal? So I love talking about this, and we spend a lot of time working that out. We say storyboards, but I would scribble a few storyboards just to lock into my role as the DP. And we had already gone and taken photos of all the locations. So it's really my favorite way to work. Now, that means that you have the foundation such that when you get on the set, you can loosen up and say, well, actually, maybe this is
sure,
cool,
or present themselves.
Let's do something right. different, or my God, who knew there'd be that truck there? Let's have that in the frame. All
the
those
truck,
things
of course.
Can have the truck. My God, the new subtext of the picture. So all of that can be, but you're not there just saying, what the hell are we going to do?
Yeah.
And I really love making films that way. It's how you make movies low budget. It's how you don't spend a lot.
Oh, right. That makes sense.
And then when you do run into a problem, you've organize yourself enough so you have the time to think when you need it, but otherwise you should just get into it.
Less panicking going on.
Yeah, there's less panicking. Right. And it's so fun to see your film slowly come together from word to drawings to photos to the actual rehearsal to the shoot. It's mm-hmm. It's just my preferred way to work. And mm-hmm. it's how I wanted to introduce Jack to the process, and he'll go from there as he sees fit.
Have you worked with people that work radically different, or, and then maybe that becomes something uncomfortable, or?
No, that's a great question. I mean, one thing that is very true of Glass Eye Picks is we often work with first-time filmmakers or second-time filmmakers, but I really like working with people who are fresh. They're still excited. They're not jaded, and they really are in it for the arts. And when I am talking to those people who maybe have a first-time script, I usually suggest this process, and they'll go along to the degree that they do. I mean, that's just it's the way you want to produce a film as well. You want to know what's going to happen. You want to be able to schedule appropriately. So, as I say, it's my methodology, and I'm sticking to it.
Jack, when it comes to working with your father so closely, do you feel like you want to be able to go your own way at any point in terms of your own ideas that may differ from Dad's, and or, you know, or you might want to develop your own process or style? I don't know if that ever came up.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the fact that I don't make horror movies sort of is is that veering off and that slight rebellion. But I, otherwise, I think the process that I've learned from my dad and that we've, you know, made movies for, for years now, you know, using, I don't think that that's just how I've adopted that. And that's how I do it now. You know, I make it my own.
Well, now we know what it, the movie isn't. It's not a horror film. What is it? So do you want to give a little bit of the synopsis so people, because I did, should have done that probably at the beginning.
Well, it's sort of a...
Should check for the batteries too, by the way.
Stray Bullets is sort of a crime thriller that brings the story of these two kids, two teenage boys upstate that are going to clean out their dad's trailer. And they've got they've had a paintball gun shipped to one of the kids, you know, his boss's house or something. And so it's sort of this little heist in the beginning where they're breaking into his house and they've got all these packages. And so it brings that story of these two kids, you know, wandering around upstate eventually to end up at this trailer to clean it out. And then we also follow these crooks, on the run from a job gone wrong in the city, and they're driving upstate, and one of them's shot in the back, and then eventually the two stories collide.
Right. So two different threads.
Yeah.
That eventually conjoin.
Yeah.
To create Stray Bullets.
Mm-hmm.
And the heist characters, mm-hmm. one of which is Larry Fessenden,
mm-hmm.
another is James LaRose. Any others? What's the third guy?
John Spyridakis.
John Spyridakis.
Yes.
That's right. He was going to potentially do this too? Or was that something we mentioned? Or? Okay. If it happens. And then you play, obviously, you're one of the two friends that you mentioned in the other thread, right?
Yeah.
And it is surprisingly, it's pretty intense. This is a movie kind of geared toward, movie geared towards adults, wouldn't you say? I mean, in terms of the amount of violence or tension and
I don't know, I never really think about an intended audience when I make a movie or think of a story. I have, this movie is for me, you know, I wanted to see it, and I just, you have to hope that others will too. I think that, you know, kids my age can enjoy it. It's very much a story about boys playing with guns, you know, teenage boys playing with guns. I grew up making movies with, you know, Nerf guns and stuff, and I've graduated to the paintball guns, and of course the crooks have their real guns, and I was very adamant about getting realistic looking replicas, because I think that when you see a, you know, a plasticky looking fake gun in a movie, that just takes you right out of it. We had to choose where to spend our small amount of money, but very insistent upon the guns being, because, you know, it's a major element in the movie. And so I was very insistent upon the guns being realistic. We had blanks when they were fired. Those were actually shots going off, blank firing, you know, replica guns. And, you know, each character has their own gun that looks, you know, that fits their character. Cody has like the shiny 911, Colt 911 or whatever, you know.
But did you have to do research on this?
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, we used the weapon specialist out in Brooklyn, which I've sort of, we've worked with them before. But they have a specialist that comes to set and teaches the actors how to handle the weapons, and you also have to have the cops there. Because when we shot in the city, that scene in Brooklyn where they're, you know, it's the shootout scene, that was, we were not able to shut that street down or anything, so we were really just sort of operating when we could and hoping that we wouldn't, you know, scare anybody, but we did have the cops there. So that was technically checked out.
Right. But I guess that's true. Passersby might all of a sudden.
Well, it's funny because we talk about, and now I'm stuck on this idea because of the process, because I've also made movies that have been improv and so on. So I don't want to overstress the idea of the pre-planning, but here's an example: is that we went to a location near Gowanus in Brooklyn to shoot the shootout, and we had an arrangement with our friends to use their pull-up garage and stuff. But across the street was this fantastic location, and Chris Gotchapol, who worked on the movie, he went over and made the arrangements, and so we shot in this fantastic location that really is one of the iconic imagery in the film. And that was an example of, you know, we had our backup plan. We had the plan. That's what brought us there. The cops met us there. But then we said, hey, there's an even better spot here. And we sort of rebuilt the whole scene. And that was a really, it's a great, great location.
Speaking of which, it wasn't in the scene where in Goodfellas, where De Niro sends, what's the actress? Of course, Lorraine Bracco, wasn't it? Was it
Lorraine
Bracco? Mm-hmm. He goes, you know, she's like, while you're here, why don't you pick out a couple of dresses for yourself on the rack? He goes, oh, thank you. And she goes, just go down there. And then Shannon, just go down there. It's like he's going, okay. my listeners are, of course, very confused because they couldn't see my hand.
Well, yes, that's why you really need a TV show so you can do your De Niro imitation. It's really
clearly. But I think that was shot in the Gowanus area. I think that was shot that they, you know, where that scene was.
That was the whole point of the anecdote.
Yeah. Because
I think they shot it in Brooklyn. You know, come on, hey.
No, I think it was shot. I remember that because having lived nearby that area, though, that looked like. And then there's something about that scene, the shootout in Straight Bullets, looked a little familiar. Like maybe, you know, it wasn't too far or something like that.
Yeah.
You know.
It's a great neighborhood. And, you know, in the distance, in the background, you can see the storied canal
right.
And it says dead end. And it
sure
has a great, it's a great neighborhood to shoot in. I've done a couple movies there actually.
Oh yeah.
But it's because we were kicked out of Dumbo. We were going to shoot in the Glass Eye Picks has a, the building has a roll up door, and we'd made another movie there. One of Jack's adaptation of Shakespeare. And which has guns instead of swords.
This is the short? Is that what you're saying?
This is, Jack has made these various films, mm-hmm. which we consider his films, but he also made some movies for school, which I let him use real music, which is what our tension always is. Ever since he was little, I said, you have to score your own films. We can't afford real music.
Right. By the way, I did forget to mention that as well. You scored the picture as well.
So Jack has done the music for all his films, mm-hmm. but when he makes some movies for you know, English class, a scene out of Midsummer Night's Dream, he's allowed to use, you know, Prokofiev. And it gets exciting. Anyway, we had filmed there, but they had put a limitation on the amount of movies that they would let you shoot in Dumbo. So the very location, literally our building and our landlord was kind enough to let us shoot there. Well, we couldn't permit. So we were thrust into the bowels of Brooklyn, and we shot in Gowanus, and we were very lucky. It was a better looking set.
Well, it's a good thing, Larry, that Jack's your only kid, right?
Yeah, so far.
if this works out.
That I know of, isn't that what you're supposed to say? Yeah.
Oh, this is your only child. That's what I think I was getting at.
I was making a series of off-color remarks. That's where the machine broke.
Very presidential of you. Well, in a sense, it's a good thing. I mean, otherwise you'd have to be helping all your children with their
It would be like a full
careers.
Yeah,
you wouldn't have any time for your own projects.
I still don't.
Well, this really did have to take, but it's under the auspices of Glass Eye Picks, right? At the production company.
Well, the funny thing is that you really do have a lot of children that you have to help out with their films, don't you?
First time filmmakers, are those your kids? Larry's kids?
They really are. Mm-hmm. I don't know how I got into this. You know why? It's because I wanted to be treated nicely, and I didn't feel the business was very nurturing or welcoming. So I made it my mission to help other people, and I've had a great time of it. And just like with Stray Bullets, I'm so proud of this movie. I'm perfectly happy to spend time on it. And, you know, you work with a distributor, and you call them, and we have to deal with the poster. And I pull Jack out of his homework, and we say, do you want to approve the poster? Did we do this with the billing block? Are the colors okay? And that goes on and on. There's all manner of decisions to be made in the, and you know, we have a great company, Screen Media, that's putting it out, and they're very inclusive. And so there's a lot of work from here. Also, a fantastic announcement that we're going to have the score on Lakeshore Records, which is a wonderful label. And so that's another, then you have to choose the, make the little booklet and the statements and this and that.
And
it's all
liner
good,
notes
good
and
problems to have, but it does take a lot of management.
Right. So it's a pretty incredible opportunity, Jack, for you, because by the time you're on your own, and that's coming probably sooner than later. Yeah, but real sort of head start on a lot of
things. Yeah, I mean, that's part of the
reason.
Just
don't decide to go to medical school or anything.
Yeah, exactly. No, I won't. You know. It's part of the reason I don't really want to go to film schools because I do sort of – I'm a little ahead of the game at this mm-hmm. point. You know, it doesn't mean that when I'm in my early 20s, there won't be someone – you know, who's way better, who takes off. But
there's
right now,
there's always somebody way better. There's always somebody
yeah,
way
but, better. But right now I am a little bit ahead of the game. So I want to go to a, you know, a type of college and spend those kind of years just sort of exploring and mm-hmm. still focusing on my movies. And music, of course, is very important to me also. Mm-hmm. I'm in a band and I love composing for my movies and play guitar a lot.
What's your band?
The Strangers. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We rehearsed just across the street, on Second Avenue and we've, it's been 5 years now or something. I was like 11 when we started, maybe 6 years even.
Three
albums out, fourth one on the way. I play drums uh-huh. in the band. We're a three-piece sort of punk rock band, but uh-huh. we're veering off into very cool, you know, indie rock sounds. We have my very good friend Dalton is the songwriter, and he's a genius, a musical genius.
Okay. And is his music... Did he contribute to the soundtrack?
No, he actually didn't. No.
Okay.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, there's some Stranger songs. You know how the park has an ambience, the park next uh-huh. door to the trailer. Some of the music from there was our band.
I see. Well, but Larry, you're in a band too, though, right, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm in a, I don't know what you call it, pub rock, folk, Tom Waitsy kind of. Mm-hmm. We were once called Indistinguishable Groaners. Me and my friend Tom Lavrek. But we played music since the 70s. Dig that. And we're actually working on a new album.
You
so
are.
We put a new album out every 10 years.
I think
the public just can't.
They can't get enough. Yeah. Every administration, it's time for new.
But we're called Just work. Desserts. And you just can. Desserts. But we even have, I must say it's my proudest moment. Uh-huh. We have a Pandora channel. That is cool.
That is. Not many people that can say that. Nobody on my show in the past has.
Well, there you go. You see. One. That's why you keep having me back.
I know.
Who knows what I'll be promoting next?
Exactly.
My cookbook. Do you know about Glass Eye Fixins? The hot sauce line that we offer? You can order it on the Glass Eye store. Sorry, I digress.
That's okay.
Stray Bullets, please. My son.
Getting back to okay, so again, Stray Bullets. It's directed, written, edited, scored, acted in by Jack Essendon, and I guess it produced is your role, Larry.
Yes, he's okay. A producer. My father.
Keep your hands to yourself, sir.
I also am credited as a producer.
Oh, you know they're okay. Well,
and your mother
and my mom.
Oh yes,
yeah, it's a family affair.
Beck Underwood.
Yes, Beck Underwood was, of course, an essential component of this. She's just a little more camera shy than her, mm-hmm. Than the men in the family. But she's a production designer, and
she got us all a lot of the locations. And Jack and I were sitting around, and he got a text on the phone, and she said, "What was it? Is this?"
Well, she sent us a picture of the Dodge Dart that did end up in the movie, and she said, "Is this too cute or is this too much or something?" And we were like, "That's perfect."
Yeah, it was so exciting. So that became a major character in the movie for us. And we got it for whatever it was.
It was $1,100.
Yeah.
Wow.
So that was... So it was the guns in the car that cost the money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if you're making a film, make note.
Spend your money on the guns.
But the guns also included the bringing the having to have the consultant, specialist come and
exactly.
All that. It's all in there, in that line item, right? Straight Bullets is, again, premiering on the 10th, was it?
The 10th of February
at Village East in Manhattan and in cities around the country. Same day?
Yeah.
Okay, great. We're going to have a big gala party on the 9th, evening of the 9th. So what we'll do is I'll put up information about that. But you can also, what's the best way to get information about Stray Bullets and like that event and the theatrical?
Well, you can go to StrayBulletsTheMovie.com, which is Scream Media, our distributor's website for us. And I suppose you could also go to Village East and get tickets, that kind of thing.
And it's going to be on iTunes and Amazon, day and date on the 10th.
Mm-hmm.
And Screen Media, that site, Stray Bullets, the movie, has all the other theatrical locations around the country. So mm-hmm. it's opening in L.A., and I guess we went through all this stuff.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Just also for the information about that, the premiere night, I guess that'll be on the website or the maybe a Facebook page, or what do you think?
Yeah, we're going to – we'll promote that. It's the 9 o'clock show on mm-hmm. Thursday the 9th at Village East in New York City.
You're just doing the one on that night?
Yeah, and Jack will do a Q&A. He'll also do a Q&A on that Saturday night, mm-hmm. and he'll do a Q&A in Boston at the Apple Cinemas in Cambridge on Friday night. So we're all over the joint.
That's the official chime that ends our segment. Thank you, guys. Really appreciate your
thank you.
Coming on the
it's
show
great.
And
thank
looking
you.
Forward to all the success for the movie. Thanks for tuning. Thank you, everybody, for listening to episode 390 of the podcast. I should just mention, coming up in the next few weeks, conversations with Noah Eisenberg, who is the author of a new book called We'll Always Have Casablanca, which is having its 75th anniversary. It's just enjoying a 75th anniversary, and Noah's book is hitting stores in February, and we're going to have him on. And I'm also bringing on the guys from this podcast, Le Grand Boeuf, which is a podcast with two guys talking about a movie each episode, a classic movie. Also coming up on the show, the repertory programmer at Film Forum for decades now, Bruce Goldstein. What a terrific guest he was. And much more coming up in the next few weeks. So please continue to tune into the show. Please go to iTunes and leave me a beautiful comment and star rating right now. I mean, assuming you're already a subscriber. If you're not, for God's sake, subscribe first, then leave a star rating and a comment on iTunes. Go to the iTunes store, search FilmWax. It'll come up and just do what I tell you to do, for Pete's sake. And then after that, you can also like us on Facebook if you go to facebook.com/FilmWaxRadio. And we're on Instagram, and we're on Twitter. With the name @FilmWaxRadio. Not only are shows available on iTunes, by the way, and on the Rooftop Films website, but they're also available for you Samsung phone people and other smartphone users that are not iPhone users. We're available through the Stitcher app as well. And even though it's a little bit more stripped down in the editing of it, we're also I'm putting episodes up on YouTube, on the FilmWax Radio channel on YouTube. So there you go. Lots of ways to listen to the show and share it. Thank you very kindly. FilmWax Radio is part of the Showbiz Studios podcast network and presented by Rooftop Films. Thank you for listening. Please do take care of yourself and the ones you love. Until next time.